UK Wine Show, show number 107. Sam Harrop on wine faults and reduction. On this week's show, we cast our final look into wine pricing in the spotlight. Sam Harrop gives us the latest on wine faults based on his research.
Cork taint isn't as big an issue as it perhaps was suggested to be in the past.
And in the news, consumer survey shows Brits lack confidence when it comes to wine, and England to double production in time for Olympics.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 107 for the 30th of May 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Sam Harrop. Sam is an MW, winemaker, and an expert on all things wrong with wine. We're going to be talking with Sam about the International Wine Challenge Faults Clinic, some of the early results and the trends from that clinic. Now, the interview is a long one, and it's actually going to be divided up into three-part series looking at wine faults. This week is an overview on wine faults, and we focus on reductive wine faults, something that has come more and more to the front over the last couple of years, with some in the cork industry indicating that the fault is even worse than cork taint. Next week, we talk with Sam about volatile acidity, and in the final part, we talk about Brettanomyces. These shows are a bit technical, but they're certainly worth listening to if you want to know more about wine faults. But before we get into all things wrong with wine, let's find out what's good with wine and the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. Well, recent research by Australian brand Hardy's has shown that British consumers are still confused about wine. And there's quite a number of us who don't feel confident about choosing it. Hardy's surveyed people in 11 cities and found that London is the place where wine is the drink of choice. 70% of those polled there opt for it as first choice. Overall, though, more women than men choose wine, with 74% of females compared to 61% of men. But when it came to how confident they felt about choosing wine in a shop, bar or restaurant, 48% of women and 39% of men said they weren't. It was the Glaswegians at 55% who are most unsure about what to choose, while people in York apparently are the most confident wine drinkers. Only 30% needed help buying wine. Chris, any thoughts?
Well, I mentioned the survey last week, and I think it is designed to come up with a number of funny results. So I don't think we should take too much from it. And I think the questions were a bit leading to get those results. So I'm not convinced about it. But in the UK, we are exposed to a lot of wine, and it can be very confusing. You know, you stand in front of a supermarket shelf and you've got wines from all over the world. I think if you're French, buying wine in France is probably a lot easier. You know the language, you know the geography and the climate, and you probably know the local wines that are only available in the stores. Let's face it, you're not likely to see many Aussie wines in a French supermarket or Chilean wines or New Zealand. So in the UK, with a huge range of wines we have, it's not surprising we get a wee bit confused. Well, Jane, English Wine Week's over for another year, but things are still going forward. What's the story with the new plantings that have been going on lately?
Well, next up is news that English wine production is going to more than double by 2012, just in time for the Olympics. Around 20 new vineyards were planted last year, and most of these were for production of sparkling wine, planted with the traditional champagne grapes of Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and to a lesser extent Pinot Meunier. There are other varieties being planted for making still wine, with Bacchus leading the way. Current plantings, including those for this year, are around 1,250 hectares. That's according to Stephen Skelton, MW, author of The Wines of Britain and Ireland. And 5 years ago, there were 773 hectares, which means plantings have increased by over 60%. The top five grapes are Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Bacchus, Reichensteiner and Sauval Blanc.
Another grape to keep a lookout for is Rondo. I've had some great English Rondos. Rondo is a red grape. Sadly, much of it's now being blended into rosés, which, to be honest, English rosé, when young and fresh, is certainly one of the nicest around I know of. I know everybody goes to the fizz, but if it wasn't for English rosé, I'd still be poo-pooing rosé and not drinking it as a very serious drink. Any more news stories this week, Jane?
Yep, well, finally this week, more research findings. A survey of 1,000 UK wine drinkers on behalf of the Wine and Spirit Association has found that, surprise, surprise, consumers will carry on drinking wine despite the economic downturn. More than 60% did not consider wine to be a high priority for cutbacks, and overall they are more likely to cut their spending on confectionery, beer and soft drinks. The survey comes as wine prices are being forced up by a combination of excise duty increases and escalating production and supply chain costs, so the survey says. But less than half of those surveyed did not believe that wine had become more expensive in the past 6 months. This was in stark contrast to their perceptions of other categories, such as bread, fish, cheese and coffee. The message from the survey is that wine will not be the first thing to go for the majority of wine consumers. That's it from me this week, but don't forget you can get more detail on these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Drink isn't often the first thing to go in a recession, if that's where we land up with in the next year or so. Often, consumption goes up, but certainly the higher-end wine market may feel the pinch. And with the pound devaluing, many of the countries supplying will take a jump in price. And with the huge jump in tax that we received this year, it's not surprising that many of the wines we normally drink are going to go up. So, either expect a drop in quality or an increase in spend on wine. This links beautifully to our next topic, which is part 3 on wine pricing. And this week we're asking, are super premium wines really worth it? So, part 3, super premium wines. Are they worth it? Generally speaking, there are three price and quality tiers in the UK wine market. Entry-level wines, up to £5. Premium, at up to £20. And super premium, which is anything above £20. Pricing of super premium wines vary from country to country. In France, you can pay well into hundreds of pounds from Bordeaux, for example. The best Californian wines, usually from Napa Valley, can command prices of around £100. While Australian super premium wines are much more affordable, with many below £100. But they're still on par in quality terms. At the end of the day, whether it's worth paying premium prices is down to you to decide. Only you know if a wine is worth the price you've paid, and it is all relative. Most people in the UK spend below £5 on a bottle of wine, which they purchase for everyday drinking. To my in-laws, a £6 bottle of wine is an expensive bottle of wine. Quantity wins over quality for them, but they are more than happy with what they drink. For others, a £10 bottle of wine is considered about the right price. We tend to buy wine at certain prices based on our budget, how often we drink, and our wine knowledge and experience, and our passion for it. The more knowledge you have, the more you're willing to pay. However, once we settle on a price range, we tend to stick with it unless there's a special occasion. Then that special bottle is produced and consumed with even greater pleasure than usual. The occasion is one element that makes wine special. Anticipation adds the enjoyment, especially if you've been patiently aging the wine for a number of years. A connection with the wine also helps. You may have visited the winery on your honeymoon or holiday. Drinking the same wine back home allows you to relive that experience. Remember, not all wines travel well though. A Rose d'Anjou in southern France just isn't the same back in old Blighty. Making it personal to you will make it worth it to you. Some wines are iconic. Take Cloudy Bay, Penfolds Grange, or Chateau Mouton Rothschild. They are often famous because of the place or a person, or because they were first to create a new style. Many hold New Zealand's Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc in highest regard because Cloudy Bay introduced a new style of Sauvignon Blanc to the world. You could consider Cloudy Bay in the same terms as a Monet, both the first to show the world a new style. There'll always be people who follow them, some making even better wines. But we would all love to own a Monet. However, wine is not art, which can be looked after and enjoyed forever. Wine does turn to vinegar eventually. And with all wines after consumption, there's nothing left to enjoy. That said, a bottle from a great vintage and a famous producer that's, say, 200 years old is worth a small fortune. The wines may taste terrible if consumed, but scarcity and supply and demand mean the wine is valuable and will probably never be opened. The key point I'm trying to get across is expensive wines offer value to different people for very different reasons. When you spend over £20 on a bottle, make sure you know why you're buying that wine and spending over £20. You can almost certainly find another bottle virtually as good a quality that's cheaper. That ends this week's look at pricing. Next week we're looking at the results from our wine poll, which, if you recall, is which one of the following do you prefer to drink when going out? Still or sparkling wine? Beer? Cider? spirit-based drinks or cocktails or other. Do you have your say? You can go to ukwineshow.co.uk and click the poll question on the right-hand side. If you've selected wine when you go out in the poll, I wonder if you've ever taken wine back and said, no, it's faulty. Sam Harrop, in this week's interview, thinks that around 7-8% of all wine we drink is faulty. That's a shocking statement. And what other industry would you expect 1 in 14 products to be no good? But before we get into the interview, you must be warned, the interview is fairly technical. I'm not going to mince words with that. You can't really talk about faults without actually getting into what's going on in the bottle. I'll recap some of the key points at the end. But if there's something that we say that you don't understand, please drop me an email at chris.scott@ukwineshow.co.uk. More than happy to have a chat to you about it and see if I can set you right. But let's have a listen to what Sam has to say. Hi, I'm here with Sam Harrop, MW and fault expert. How are you, Sam?
I'm very well, thanks, Chris.
We're at the International Wine Competitions tasting at the moment, and you're the man who manages the faults clinic.
Well, that's part of my role. I'm co-chairman, yep. So I get to taste all of the wines that get judged out by the various panels we have. I taste them again with the other four co-chairmen. But in addition, I also look after the faults, basically analysing hundreds of wines that get rejected from the competition for various faults. What I then try to do is classify those various faults to come up with some trends for the industry to help winemakers improve their winemaking, packaging, approach to the market effectively to come up with better quality, better value wines.
Knowing quite a bit about faults, how did you get this knowledge? You know, where did you start out and, you know, quickly, how did you get here?
Well, when I started off as a winemaker in New Zealand. I went to Lincoln University. I then was a winemaking cadet at Villa Maria for 3 years. It was a very interesting role that took me throughout, from sales to viticulture to winemaking, so I got to see all aspects of the business. It was fascinating. I then went on an overseas vintage, like a lot of New Zealand winemakers do, to California, and got the bug for travel and decided to head to Europe, and somehow ended up in England. Found a role at Marks & Spencer's as a winemaker for Marks & Spencer's, which took me all over the world, selecting, blending, sourcing wines for Marks & Spencer's, who effectively have an entire product range that's exclusive. So there was a lot of blending, a lot of technical work. And to answer the question, how do I get interested in faults from that sort of brief CV? At Marks & Spencer's, part of my role was quality control. And I always, from day one of studying winemaking, I always had a fascination in faults. Primarily because I think you see with faults, there's almost a contradiction in some respects. You know, to one man, a fault is evil, and to another man, the same compound is beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, and I often, in England in particular, I often found wine experts smelling a wine, tasting wine, saying, this is fantastic. And as a New World winemaker, trained to, you know, produce sterile, almost hygienic wine styles, using all the technology and all the tricks, I got a little sort of curious about how one man can think or one woman can think what I see as a faulty wine can be so beautiful. And it's true, there is a bridge, really, and it is a fine line between pleasure and pain. So that got me interested.
Okay, you might hear a bit of popping noise and a bit, maybe even a bit of singing, because we're at the Barbican Centre in the background, so it's just for the listeners. So far, the faults, you did a big report a couple of years ago. Is it every year that you do a report for the International Wine Competition?
Well, that was the plan when we started 3 years ago. If we go back a step, I mean, I came on board as a co-chairman 3 years ago, and before that, the faults were analysed, but in a very simple fashion. It was pretty much just cork taint.
Yeah.
There was a lack of technical sort of expertise in the chairman sort of role, and when I came on board as a winemaker, I thought, hey, what a great opportunity. Well, you know, we taste 13,000 wines over 2 weeks. It's phenomenal. It's the biggest wine competition in the world. And it was just a great opportunity to get those trends for the industry. So I decided to, you know, get in there a little further and not just look at cork taint, start to look at Brett, Brettanomyces, which is a yeast that is very tolerant to alcohol and sulfur dioxide. That is, I believe, to be a massive problem with the industry right now. Sulfides, or reduction, is often is the term that's used, is a huge problem. In fact, bigger than, in some instances, I think, bigger than cork taint. I think in the past, what I found from my analysis is that we, in 2005, before I came on board, cork taint rate was around just over 6%. It varied from year to year. When I came on board the first year, in 2006, we found the cork taint halved. And so all of a sudden, I'm thinking, how can this happen, you know? Yeah, I mean, from 1 year to the next. I mean, the cork industry isn't that proactive, right?
Yeah.
And so it got me thinking, well, actually, one of the problems is that because faults are so difficult for consumers and even for experts to understand, a lot of faults just get clumped in the cork taint category.
Yep.
I'm not saying that there isn't a huge problem with cork taint. We all know there is a big problem. And I don't defend the cork industry very often, I've got to say. But the fact is that my research has shown that cork taint isn't as big an issue as it perhaps was suggested to be in the past. And some of these other faults, like Brettanomyces, sulfide, and and sulfide can come in a lot of different shapes and forms as well, but a lot of these other faults can actually be classified as cork taint. So that's my role, to sort of try as best I can to categorize the faults accurately. It's sensory-based, so it's never going to be 100%. Answer your question. Sorry, I went off on a bit of a diatribe there. We did a report in the first year. It's a sensitive issue. A lot of people picked up on the analysis and ran with it, and there was a bit of hyperbole in the national media in the UK and all around the world. So I decided to just hang 10 for the second year, develop a strategy for communicating this information, and just hang 10. And we're going to launch the analysis this year from 2008 International Wine Challenge as a single year, but also for the last 3 years, so that we can actually start to identify some trends from year to year.
Oh, okay.
So it has more resonance in effect.
Is there any wee trends that you want to give us now?
Yeah, the biggest trend, and it's a big concern, is that excessive sulfide, which, H2S is the classic sulfide, isn't it, with smells like egg. But the mercaptans, cauliflower, vegetable flavors, complex sulfides. And what we're finding as a category, excessive sulfides in the wine, where indeed these off flavors dominate to such an extent where you can't pick up any fruit, they become ugly in essence, is actually bigger than cork taint. In the first 2 days of the challenge this year, we're finding that sulfides are a bigger issue than cork taint. Now, what that actually suggests is that winemaking is a there's a serious issue of winemaking. And I've been thinking about this over the last few years, and I believe that with the movement towards these new world techniques in the old world, i.e. reductive winemaking, hygienic winemaking, making fruit-driven intense styles of wine, the winemakers, they're trying hard, but they're actually forgetting to look after perhaps the yeast, giving nutrients to the yeast, and what that actually results in is these excessive sulfides, because the yeast struggles through fermentation.
Do you just get stuck fermentation?
That's also a problem. We've seen increases in volatile acidity over the last 3 years as well, and that, of course, during a stuck ferment, you get higher volatile acidity, but also you get sulfides. But no, what I'm talking about, health effectively ferments that go to dryness, but the wine is full of sulfites because there wasn't the necessary nutrients for that yeast to perform effectively. Effectively, the yeast was stressed and produces these sulfites, which, if they're not treated effectively in the winery, they can complex, and then you just can't get rid of them. So effectively, the old world winemakers, they're trying hard, but perhaps they need to focus in on a couple of key areas of fermentation.
It's not just because they're using too much sulfur dioxide in the field to protect the grapes and then bringing them into the winery.
Absolutely. I mean, I focused on nutrients here. That's one part of it. It's an important part of it, but you're right. It's the whole reductive approach to winemaking as well. And, of course, sulfur dioxide in the vineyard is the start of it, or the reductive approach, ascorbic acid as well.
Vitamin C is ascorbic acid, isn't it?
Yeah, is used a lot more throughout the winemaking. And so what you're effectively doing by using sulfur dioxide and ascorbic acid is scavenging the oxygen, so there's very little oxygen. Now, yeast actually need oxygen to reproduce. And to have a healthy ferment also, you need a lot of a large yeast population. And if you don't, the yeast population isn't high enough, the yeast will struggle at some stage during the fermentation with or without the necessary amounts of nutrients. So that's something that's also forgotten. You know, you can... By protecting your juice too much, you can effectively make the yeast more stressed, and that can result in sulfides as well.
And the reason they're protecting the juice from the oxygen is to emphasize the fruit, isn't it?
Absolutely. You get these wonderful thiol characters, certainly in aromatic white varieties, by protecting the wine from oxygen. But what I'm suggesting is you can go too far. I mean, the classic for thiol production is obviously, you know, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what's interesting, I mean, if forget faults for one second, but if you look to Chile and Sauvignon Blanc from Chile nowadays, I mean, the aromatic profile of these wines is very similar to New Zealand. It's a winemaking character. Of course, New Zealand has something special. We all know that, whether it's the soil, the sun, a lack of ozone, you know, who knows. But the world is catching up to New Zealand in terms of aromatics.
Yeah, I've had some very good South African savvies as well.
Absolutely, yeah, and Australia too. Adelaide Hills, that's what we've found at this tasting this year, is some of the aromatic whites are just fantastic. Coming back to faults for a second, if we just say that the new world is actually moving towards this reductive approach, there are also pitfalls in that process as well, and we are starting to see reduction issues with screw cap.
Yeah, I was going to say, because a lot of people talk about the fact that there's no oxygen getting through into the screw cap, and that some people talk about the development of sulfur because of the screw cap. The faults you're getting with the sulfur issues, are they under cork or under screw cap dominated?
Okay, we're looking at sulfides on a number of levels. Effectively, we look at the closure when a wine is rejected for showing excessive sulfides. We look at the closure. Effectively, we're categorizing them to three categories. So we're looking at screw cap, we're looking at natural cork, and then we're just looking at the wine itself. So I'll give you an example. Wine is rejected for showing excessive sulfides, as a vegetable character on the nose and very little fruit. Clearly, the mercaptans have taken control of the wine.
Mercaptans are the
complex sulfides, yeah.
Yeah, they're the cauliflowers, the garlic.
Absolute onion, all that sort of thing. They can express themselves in almost a burnt sort of rubber character in extreme, not attractive. So the wine's been rejected. It's a screw cap wine. I taste it out the back, I record that detail, and I ask for another bottle. If the second bottle shows the same character, it's the batch. Okay, the batch is faulty. We have a rule in the International Wine Challenge, two strikes and you're out. If two of the wines are faulty, then it's rejected from the competition. But of course, we have to give the benefit of the doubt. If the first bottle's faulty, we ask for a second and give them a chance. So in that instance, the screw cap is creating an environment, an extremely reductive environment, and if the wine is not prepared properly before bottling, the sulfides can develop in bottle, because it's screw cap's extremely reductive seal, more so than cork actually. And so winemakers can treat the wine in a number of ways to reduce the chance of that sulfide development after bottling. You can monitor the dissolved oxygen and make sure that the DO is not too low before you bottle. You can add copper, which isn't something I support, but it's used extensively just before bottling in the new world.
That creates copper sulfide, doesn't it? Which that you can then, it's like a fining agent.
Exactly. It fines out of solution, and then you rack the wine off the sediment. It takes the precursors and the sulfides out of solution. But it doesn't work at all on complex sulfides. So you've got to get... It only takes the free sulfides out.
Oh, okay, yep.
So you've got to get onto it early. So, you know, there's other techniques as well.
Just on that, so
yep.
Free sulfides, you get some free sulfides in a bottle, they get to develop, and they develop more complexity, and then they develop these onion cauliflower flavours, and they're the mercaptans.
Mm. Correct, yeah. Well, and on that point, and this is fascinating, you know, because there would be a lot of your listeners right now thinking, well, but hey, isn't great Chablis sort of all about these types of characters.
Minerality.
And I've looked at Chablis with a lot of interest because when I was at M&S, I used to look after it. It was one of my areas of responsibility. And this is where it becomes a little hypocritical in a sense because, and coming back to what I said very early in the interview about, you know, one man's pleasure is another man's poison, you know, I mean, Chablis, if you go to Chablis, the winemakers will talk of terroir and this mineral terroir. For me, this mineral terroir almost verges on cauliflower in some instances. And it, to me, it can also be a fault in Chablis, but it's a little more accepted by the trade because it is the style. It's typicity. Always been the style. It's typicity, it's terroir. But still, I believe it becomes a fault when it dominates in Chablis. Okay, it needs a certain level of fresh fruit to support it. It's all about balance, and that's very much the approach we take to defining wine quality in the International Wine Challenge. It's all about balance. So you can have a little bit of Brettanomyces or volatile phenols from Brettanomyces. You can have a little bit of sulfides, if they're the right type of sulfides for the wine style. You can have a little bit of VA, if it's the right sort of wine style. For example, Pinot Noir can handle a little bit of VA. It's
volatile,
terrific.
Acidity,
but it's all about balance, and it needs the fresh fruit, the stable fruit, to support it. Now, you might have a lot of your listeners who are Australian, New Zealand, or New World winemakers who may disagree with that, because in wine competitions in the New World, they have a much tougher approach to assessing faults. If the wine shows any volatile phenols, it's kicked out. Sulfides, it's kicked out. They're much harder. But we're based in England. We're an international wine competition. We have to consider not just the New World, but the Old World. And the Old World has more minerality. It has more complexity, generally speaking, as a category. And many of these mineral and complexing characters are the same compounds that the Australians and New Zealanders are knocking out for faults. So it's very polarized, and we have to find middle ground, which is really what we strive to do. It's a complex area, but it's a fascinating area as well.
Just to wrap up, what sort of numbers in terms of faults, what are the sort of typical numbers that you're seeing at the moment?
In the last 2 years, we're seeing around 8% of total wines tasted being faulty. 8%, which is huge, really, isn't it? And once again, this is not just all about cork taint. This is about all these other categories I was talking about, sulfides, volatile acidity. You know, we're looking at pinking. We're looking at rot. We're looking at a number of faults.
I've never heard of pinking. What's that?
Well, pinking in white varietals, in particular Sauvignon Blanc and Viognier, tend to show it in warm years from warm regions where effectively it's a oxidation of the anthocyanins, proanthocyanins, I believe.
And going what, a pink colour?
Going a pink colour. And it gets worse, and it effectively a wine that's pink, it develops in bottling, it will lose part of its freshness. It's a form of oxidation. It's not as bad as just a general sort of oxidation of the wine. It's a much slower process, but we consider it a fault because if a customer's ordering or buying a Sauvignon Blanc from a retailer, they actually want it to look clear as well.
Color rosé.
Exactly. And believe it or not, color has become more and more important over the years to consumers. You know, in the States in particular, you know, one of the key quality criteria for judges and for consumers alike is the density and the vibrancy of the color, certainly for red wines. And equally for white wines, they want them to be clear, stable, vibrant, not sort of slightly pink or gray as they tend to go under this pinking fault. So yeah, we're looking at everything. So 8% in the last couple of years. Interesting enough, this year in 2008, we're looking at a slightly lower rate, about 7% in the first three days. Now, if one keeps in mind that this is a competition that goes over 2 weeks.
How does it break down within that? You know, what's the rate of TCA, sulfur, pinking, all that sort of stuff?
Well, the first point, as I raised earlier in the interview, is that cork taint is a lot lower than what other studies have shown. We saw in 2006 a cork taint rate for every wine bottled with natural cork, okay, of 2.91%.
Okay, so around 3%, yeah.
3%, so it's a lot lower than, you know, the previously accepted figure of between 5 and 10% that was thrown around for years, isn't it? Now, in 2007, interestingly enough, this increased to 3.29%.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, it's still a lot lower than what we thought, but it increased last year. We don't know why. I mean, once again, I taste every single fault. So one of the reasons for that is to calibrate the results. Now, a lot of the faults that get sent through for cork taint, I don't actually input into the database because I can't smell the TCA. I'm quite perceptive and sensitive to TCA, but you know, there are judges out there who are more sensitive to it. So our results are quite conservative,
yeah.
But we have to calibrate it by, you know, having one co-chairman effectively,
yep,
entering the data based on their threshold levels. Now, to go to other stats, if we look at this issue of screw cap reduction. Now, I must emphasize, it's not a taint from the screw cap.
Yes.
It's got nothing to do with the actual closure. It's a winemaking issue. The wine has not been prepared properly by the winemaker before bottling was screwed in the very reductive, yep, seal of screw caps. So let's get that clear, because I don't want your listeners to think that the screw cap is bad. I actually think the screw cap is an amazing closure. And it's no surprise that this year we're seeing more and more entries moving to screw cap. But the winemaker needs to be careful in their preparation, as I touched on earlier. Lush, in 2006, 2.23% of all wines sealed with screw cap, okay, had this reductive,
yep,
macapdan character, this onion skin character that we perceived to be a fault. It was too dominant.
Yep.
Okay. In 2007, it's increased to 2.6%, a slight increase. But when you look at the number of wines sold, well, let's just look at the UK. I know your audience is global, but let's just look at the UK. I don't know what the current figure is, but a couple of years ago, it was about 100 million cases consumed annually in the UK. Now, you know, so these are small percentiles, but in that context, big numbers, big bottle numbers for sure.
What about the effect of wines that have sulfur problems that are under a natural cork?
Yeah. Well, there's no question that natural cork varies from bottle to bottle. You know, it's not a technical closure, and you do get corks that are more elastic than others or more dense than others, and certainly the more dense corks can result in this reduction issue, much the same as screw cap, effectively.
Less oxygen gets through.
Exactly. So we do see some issue with a reduction, but it's not as significant as the more technical closure of screw cap, because effectively, if the wine is bottled with screw cap in an inadequate condition, too reductive, and there are these precursors for sulfide development post-bottling, you can end up with, you will end up with sulfide issues across the entire batch. Well, cork is not technical, it's not consistent like screw cap, but you'll see more variation depending on how the wine is prepared. What I will say, though, is I think the bigger issue with both of them is that there are many, many wines being bottled in a condition that shows excessive sulfides, and they're just going to get worse with either type of closure effectively. So winemakers really do need to up the ante on their winemaking to reduce the sulfide precursors before bottling.
Now, you talked about it being a winemaker issue with the sulfides. Do you think, for example, different countries who are adopting screw cap are going to have a higher problem rate than, say, more established countries? Obviously, like countries like New Zealand, who have been using screw cap now for quite a while and have almost completely gone screw cap, do you think they'll have less of an issue than, say, new countries who are just adopting screw cap for the first time? You know, and have you will you be able to break your statistics out by country?
Great question. And in 2006, I did do that particular analysis for the taint rate of Australia versus New Zealand.
Yep.
Okay? I mean, I can break this data down to the nth degree, and by region, by, yep, variety, by wine style. I looked at it in this instance, Australia versus New Zealand, just because I wanted to try and compare their averages against the overall average.
Yeah, sure.
What was interesting is that Australia, believe it or not, were higher than the average, which that was 2.23.
Yeah.
Okay. New Zealand was well below 1%.
Do you think that's because the winemakers now understand the issues, maybe a bit more education in New Zealand, and as a result they're managing it better?
That's absolutely my view on this particular analysis. New Zealand have been leading the way in screw cap technology, and I think in the early days, you know, a lot of producers down there would be the first to admit that they didn't have a handle on it, but, well, the results show that they are you know, getting much better at dealing with screw cap, and as a result, the wine quality and the consistency, more importantly, between bottles is much better. You know, Australia, who's also got very technical industry and has a lot of producers who led the way in screw cap, perhaps because it's a bigger region, and it's obviously, oh, it's a massive country with sort of a lot more regions spread out. You know, maybe the communication isn't quite as centralized as they would like, and certainly as New Zealand, in terms of sharing technology, sharing information to improve consistency between bottling. Now, if you look at the old world, and I haven't looked at the old world because the numbers of screw caps are so low, effectively, in this competition. I'm not saying our results are statistically significant, by the way, but these are just trends. Now, I think it's going a little too far to analyse the average of the French screw cap issues when there's only been 15 or 20 wines entered into the competition with screw cap. It would be a little rough to sort of make some calls on that. But there's no question in my mind, coming back to your point, that the longer you work with screw cap, the better you get. You know, it's a technical closure, so it's a learning curve. What I really hope for is that someone in the industry takes the lead on educating producers all around the world to improve their winemaking for screw cap closure. And, you know, there have been organisations that have tried to do this in New Zealand and Australia, but I actually think it's a responsibility of the screw cap manufacturer to invest money in educating all producers who use their closure. It's not good enough to just give the producers a bunch of screw caps and leave them to it. There needs to be a protocol. There needs to be, you know, an educational process in selling that closure. They have a responsibility.
All right, just last question. Do you think that the change of the wadding in the screw cap, where they're going to allow some permeability through the wadding, do you think that'll remove some of the issues with sulphur, or do you think it's better just to sort it out before it gets bottled?
For me, it's best to actually sort it out in the vineyard. And, you know, you've got to look to the soil and the nutrient status of the soil, because that will indirectly reflect the nutrient status in the fruit, and which in turn will lead to nutrient status in the juice, which in turn will create stress on the yeast if there's a deficiency. And it's that sulfide that the yeast produce which can then rear its ugly head further down the line in either an extremely tight natural cork or more often, as the case is, with screw caps. So you've got to go further back. And I take your point, you know, the lining of the screw cap is critical. But that's just one of many factors, you know. I've found with my clients around the world that with the more oxidative varieties like Grenache, that it perhaps a tin lining is better suited than, you know, the plastic or the Saranex, I think it's called, isn't it, lining, which is a little more oxidative, which I tend to use for the more reductive varietals such as Sauvignon Blanc. I'd never use tin on Sauvignon Blanc for sure, because it would create an extremely reductive environment, which could then lead on to these sulfides developing.
Okay, Sam, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thanks very much for your time.
No problems.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Sam. It did get a bit technical in there, but so I thought I'd recap some of the issues about reduction that were mentioned. Sulfides, H2S, are the chemicals that occur during fermentation from stressed yeast. The yeast can be stressed because of a lack of nutrients, or from overused sulfur dioxide or ascorbic acid, vitamin C. Sulfur dioxide or ascorbic acid reduce the level of oxygen that the yeasts can have, causing problems for the yeast. Sulfides, H2S, can easily be removed by copper fining. However, if it's left in the bottle, the sulfides tend to react and become more complex sulfur-based chemicals, which are very hard to get rid of. These complex sulfides, often referred to as mercaptans, create cauliflower, onion, garlic, even burnt rubber flavours in wine. Next week, we're going to continue talking with Sam about wine faults. We focus on a strange little fault known as VA, or volatile acidity. But as always, let's finish off with a wee joke. I hope you're enjoying these jokes. Jane doesn't seem to be too impressed with them, but we'll keep going until I hear some real complaints. This one's a wee bit silly, but here we go. Who is the smarter sex? A woman and a man get into a car accident. It's a bad one. both cars are totally demolished, but amazingly, neither of them are hurt. After they crawl out of their cars, the woman says, "So, you're a man. That's interesting. I'm a woman. Wow. Just look at our cars. There's nothing left. But fortunately, we're not hurt. This must be some sign from the god that we should meet and be friends and live together in peace for the rest of our days." The man replied, "I agree with you completely. This must be a sign." The woman continued, "And look here. Here's another miracle. My car is completely demolished, but this lovely bottle of Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc wine didn't break. Surely the gods want us to drink this wine and celebrate our good fortunes." The man shakes his head in agreement, opens it, and takes a few big gulps of the wine bottle, then handing it back to the woman. The woman takes the bottle and immediately puts the cap back on and hands it back to the man. The man asks, "Aren't you having anything to drink?" The woman replies, "No, I think I'll just wait for the police." Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.